Committee to order. And let the record note that it is February 1st, 2011, and the time is 1 p.m. On the agenda today, we have the Minnesota Department of Transportation, Office of Materials and Road Research, MinRoads, going to give us an update, an overview of their work. And we have with us today Keith Shannon and Kurt Turgeon. We would like to welcome you to the committee, and as you give your presentation, if you could identify yourself for the record, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Keith Shannon. I'm the Office Director for the Office of Materials and Road Research, and with me is Kurt Turgeon, who is the State Pavements Engineer from MnDOT. And appreciate the opportunity to come and share some information with you about the highway pavements in Minnesota and some of the things we're doing. Mm-hmm. Kind of some of the questions we're planning on answering is, how do we monitor pavement conditions? What are the pavement condition trends and investments, kind of looking back and also looking forward? And then what are some of our strategies to improve pavement conditions? Certainly investments is a big part of that, but some of the research and things we're doing at MinRoad and with an alliance that's been developed and some innovative strategies, we're hoping to have an impact on stretching the dollars further and making good decisions. So first, talking about monitoring pavement conditions, MnDOT measures pavement conditions on all state highways each year and 1/4 of the county state aid highway system each year. And this was started with county state aid system about 6 years ago, where they are funding us so we can measure their pavement conditions. And basically every county has this done every fourth year. And the testing involves driving both directions on roadways and measuring pavement roughness, rutting and faulting, cracking, and other pavement distress. And also we collect digital images of the pavement and the right-of-way, which is very useful for other purposes. And each year we travel about 24,000 lane miles on the trunk highway system and about 16,000 miles on the county state aid system. This is the vehicle we use to accomplish that. In the front bumper, there's three laser sensors that basically help measure the ride that the vehicle has. In the back, there's two scanners that scan back and forth and measures the rutting in the pavement. And then in the brackets in the front of the vehicle, you'll see the cameras, the digital cameras. Two are pointed down to take digital images of the pavement, which helps us then take that back to the office and determine the stresses. Cameras, one down the middle of the roadway and one off to the side. So that collects digital images of what's alongside all of our roadways, which for other people in organizations is very useful. They can sit at a computer in their office and actually see what's out on along the roadway without having to travel out and check things. So that's been a very valuable piece of information that we also collect.
With the equipment that you have here, that you're showing here, the scanners that are on the back side of the vehicle, is that giving you actual pictures, or is that a graph type of information that is fed out that you get to review?
Mr. Chair, what it does is it has a scanner that it goes back and forth. And so it actually measures the profile across the roadway. So if there's a rut, it'll actually detect a rut in the wheel path. And so it's actually lasers, and it's all fed into a computer and automated that way.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, what does a vehicle like that cost to put together?
We buy it from a company that provides not only the vehicle and the cameras, but also the computers and system to go with it, and they're about $500,000 for each system. And about every 7 or 8 years, we then have to replace the old system with a new system. And every year, they get more digital and electronic and better. And we do have ones that we have ordered now that actually will automatically, at least we hope, do this kind of monitor the cracking and measure that electronically rather than having a person actually do that. So hopefully it'll reduce some cost savings for us to get into that higher automation that will come with the next system.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Okay.
The ride quality index is a measure we use to measure the quality of the ride. And so as I talked about earlier, first the vehicle measures the ride. And then what we do is we want to correlate that to what the public may feel as they ride down those roads so that we can kind of correlate what the van is measuring and what the public feels about that ride. And so just this fall, we updated that again to do that correlation. And we put it on a 0 to 5 scale. And basically 3 or better is a good ride based on what the customer is telling us. And when you get to a level of 2 or lower, that's where the public feels it's unacceptable or needs repair and are not very happy with that. And we'll talk about those measures as I move forward. So once we collect the data, this is a map that's on a website that shows the condition we measured in 2010 statewide. And it's either poor, fair, or good condition. And the website I have at the bottom of the slide there, so you can actually go in and you can break it down by areas of the state, a district you may want to look at more closely and see what the statuses of those pavements are. So it's on the website along with some other information about our pavements. If you ever want to take a look at that, it has a lot of good information. Now, we do have performance measures. One measure is the quality of the ride that is in the good condition, and that would be a ride quality of greater than 3. So what this chart demonstrates is from 2001 to 2010, which is what we actually measured, and then the lighter color to the right are the predicted conditions based on the State Highway Transportation Program, which actually we take the actual projects that are in the program, put it in a computer model, and it will project the conditions that we'll see in those future years. You'll also notice there's two different colors. The blue is the principal arterial system, which are the higher volume roadways in the state, such as interstates or interregional corridors. The non-principal arterial are in the red. That'd be the lower volume roadways that we have in the state. And it's about 50-50. About half the roads are in principal arterial and half of them are in the non-principal category, roughly. And as you can see, in 2002, we had very good conditions. We have targets set on the 70%. You'll see a blue line, which is our target for the principal arterial to be in good condition, and then 65% is the red line, which is for the non-principals. So we kind of have a little higher target for the higher volume roadways and the lower volume roadways. The trend over the years is it has dropped some, but it kind of goes up and down, and today we're pretty close to our targets for roadways in a good category. There was a lot of pavement work done in 2010, so you can see from 2009 to 2010, there was quite an improvement in the good pavements. And then as we look forward, it looks like we'll be able to at least stay fairly close to those targets with the program that we have planned. So that's kind of the good news. I think we're doing a good job. These are the type of roadways where we can maintain them with very low-cost type fixes, and so we can maintain those roadways without a large cost per mile to do that. Now I'm going to talk about our targets for poor condition. This picture kind of shows a roadway that has a ride quality of 1.6, so it's well below the 2.0 threshold. And typically roads that are below that 2.0 threshold are in pretty poor condition, have very bad ride, and your speeds may be affected or how you drive the road may be affected when you're on those type of roadways. And we set targets for those for the principal arterial of 2% or less and for the non-principal of 3% or less. And so those are the roads that were probably having some concern and some challenges with right now as I show you some information about those. This is similar to the graph I showed previously, except this would be poor ride quality. And as the bars get bigger, that's We're getting more roads in the poor condition. So starting out in 2001, 2002, we were close at those targets that we had established. And it's been a pretty much a general increase in the number of poor roads since then. We did have an improvement in 2010, once again due to some major investments we made last summer in paving projects. But as we put in the projects that are planned over the next 4 years, the trend will continue to increase for the number of percent of poor roads that we're going to have. So that is a rising concern that we have. The cost to fix those type of roads are much more expensive because they're structural type fixes. And so to do them right, you got to provide a new structure or replace the structure in some form. This next chart just extends us out a little further in time.
Mr.
on the left
Shannon,
hand.
Before you move
yes.
on, could I ask a question? Do you have a dollar figure attached to what it would take, an estimate of what it would take to get us down at least closer to, if not to meet those targets in those major reconstruction projects?
Mr. Chair, I probably will have a chart later on that I can answer that question with a little better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Always give me that look when I ask. By the way, Senator Dibble, it wasn't because I don't like you. It's because there's a nice airflow here, so Senator Rest and I switched because it's too cold over here, and I love the coolness. But I do have a question. Do you have this broken out per district? Are there different districts have, because I seem to have just gotten District 6 report. And I was told that we have some real big issues there. So is it broken out?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I do have a chart that do show the district breakdowns
okay.
coming up also. So
right,
I should answer
you.
That question.
Thank you.
This chart on the left-hand side starts with our current conditions. And then from 2011 to 2014 would be the STIP that I had shown on the previous page, what's currently programmed as projects. And then we do have a 10-year plan, which we call the Highway Investment Plan. So from 2015 to 2020, it's taking the amount of money that the districts are planning on spending on pavement preservation. And if we invest that much money, we have a model that will predict ahead what our conditions will be in the future with those investments. And I'll also show that on a chart later on what those investment levels are. So you can see our current 10-year plan, the condition of roads that are in the poor category are going to continue to grow based on our current investment plan. So that is certainly a concern. We have did a risk assessment on the various programs at MnDOT, pavements, bridges, safety, expansion, and the pavements are at this point what we feel is a real high risk, and we're trying to invest in those as best we can. The ATPs are the Area Transportation Partnerships, and the boundaries shown on here are very similar to the district boundaries. There's just very little differences between them, but those are the planning organizations that look at the investments in each of those districts. And so that's kind of how the state breaks down by those ATPs. And then this chart shows the ATP breakdown or district breakdown pretty much. And well, we have our three bars there for each of the ATPs. The red on the left is our current condition measured in 2010. The second bar, kind of the salmon or orange color, is the predicted condition in that district at the end of the Transportation Improvement Program, which would be out to 2014. And then the last bar, the pinkish bar, is predicted out to 2020, which is at the end of the Highway Improvement Investment Plan, 10 years out. And it's rather telling. Certainly you can see some districts get a lot worse during this time frame, and others only increase a little bit. So the previous question about District 6, they have been probably for the past several years probably had the worst pavements of all the districts. They have made some investments and are kind of at least plateauing that level. But as you can see, the other districts are probably going to pass them up soon, so they'll lose their number one ranking, if that's a good thing. I don't know.
Mr.
Chair.
Sure
that causes Senator Perry
Just a quick question. I find it interesting that ATP2 is so low. Is that because of the amount of traffic? Is there no traffic to speak of up in the northwest there, or do they just build better roads and maintain them better?
Mr. Shannon.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, you know, they're in good condition now. I think one thing that's is different by districts is different districts have their wave of needs kind of hit them at different times depending on when their system was built. And also some districts, depending on other needs, may dedicate more to pavements versus, say, congestion or safety or other things. And I think in the case of District 2, they have not done a lot of expansion-type projects, so they have dedicated the majority of their funding to pavements and have did a good job of maintaining those pavements. And it appears they'll be able to do that for a period of time yet.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Perry moved because of my taser comment last meeting, but I'd like to see the slide on the good quality road, too. Do you happen to have that? The same thing with the good quality ride index?
As far as the ATPs breakout?
Breakdown.
Mr. Chair and
Mr. Shannon.
Council committee members, I don't have that in this presentation, but we could provide that at a later time.
I think that'd be interesting to see. You know, we'd appreciate it.
I think what we'll see is, I think my memory serves me well, is it's not going to look as bad as the poor, because, like I say, for small amounts of money, you can maintain that good condition, but it's very expensive to deal with the poor level. So, you know, normally the districts try their best to keep the pavements out of that poor category by doing those first. So, but we'll provide the information that you're asking for. This is a chart that, if you threw everything else away, this is kind of the one chart that kind of draws the picture, and it kind of takes the percent of poor and also shows you the number of miles that percent represents. Sometimes percents are hard to figure out what that really means, but miles is pretty clear to everybody. And then also on the bottom are kind of the investments that we have made in and plan to make in pavement preservation, and it kind of tells the story that we were in very good shape in 2002, and we invested about $221 million a year on average between then and 2009, and our poor condition roads basically tripled in size with that level of investment. And as I mentioned previously, in 2010, we did do a lot of paving projects. We had the federal ERA program, and also we had diverted some additional money that had came to MnDOT to pavement, so we had almost a $400 million program in 2010, and as you can see, it did have a positive impact on reducing the number of poor roads. And then we put 2014 there because that's the end of our STIP, where we have projects programmed, and as you can see, the investment is going to drop during that time frame down to about $282 million on average, so obviously that's not enough to sustain our 5.2% we had in 2010. And then in the highway improvement program out to 2020, at this point, the investments are planned currently to be about $205 million a year. And so you're going to see a large increase in the number of poor miles that will result from that investment level. So it kind of ties the investments and the miles and kind of the past and the future together in one slide. So I'm going to kind of switch gears and talk about kind of our strategies on how to deal with preserving the pavements. Are there any additional questions around the conditions and trends that I just covered before I move on?
Looks like you can move forward, Mr. Shannon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. MnRoad is a unique facility in the world. It's a full-scale pavement testing facility that gives us a real-life laboratory to study the performance of materials and roadway construction. This is located up on Interstate 94, just west of Albertville, known for its outlet center up there. And MnRoad was there before the outlet center, so it had nothing to do with why we built there. It was opened in 1995. It was at a cost of about $35 million and was basically funded with MnDOT or Federal Highway Administration dollars on its initial construction. And as you see on the drawing there, on the upper right, there's a low-volume road, which is basically a loop that a semi drives on it. Some of you may have seen, if you've driven by there, an orange truck driving on that roadway. And that's to simulate the type of conditions that a local road, city or county type roadway would experience. So a lot of the research that's taking place on a low volume road is relative to those type of roadways, more local type roadways. And then on Interstate 94, we added an additional set of lanes on the main line for westbound, which is where we're doing research on higher volume, higher load type pavements. Certainly we've got a lot of truck traffic, so it's a very fast way to get a lot of loads on test cells quickly so we can measure and monitor the effectiveness of those test cells. If something goes bad after a couple of years, we can move the traffic off to the other lanes and repair or fix and not interfere with the public's use of that roadway. So it's been extremely valuable in the information that we've got. It's been used nationally and internationally, the information has, and been very successful. However, when we put those pavements out there, we build them to fail. That's sometimes you learn more from failure than you learn from success, and by having a little of both, we can take those risks up there and not risk the transportation availability to the public. In 2004, we saw that we're going to have to do some reconstruction up at Min Road because the facility had been open almost 10 years, and we knew many of those cells had to be reconstructed and new research done. However, since the benefits of Min Road are so widespread, we felt that we should change the governance structure and the funding structure of Min Road so that everyone could have more input into what we do there and share in the cost of what we do there. So in 2004, we formed a new governance structure, and it's basically a partnership with government and industry and academia to have a partnership on how we advance innovation in road engineering and construction. And the because these efforts reaches well beyond Minnesota and even to other countries. So we've kind of changed that, and in the next few slides I'll kind of give you an indication of how successful that has been. This is a list of the board members of TERRA, which is the Transportation Engineering Road Research Alliance. As you can see, there's quite a list of industry represented from various industries that have certainly a stake in paving, and some that actually aren't necessarily in the paving but more of the safety arena, and a couple even private companies that represent industry. Norway is a member along with Federal Highway Administration, and then we also have several states that are members, including Michigan, New York, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, and then three universities that are involved. So we have quite a good group of people that have interest in pavements and transportation, and we collaborate on the things we're going to do. So this is an example. In 2008, we did a major project to reconstruct a large number of the cells, not only on the low-volume road, but the mainline road. And it was about $10.9 million if you include all the construction and instrumentation and the support that goes behind that. And this pie chart kind of gives you an idea of where the source of the funding for that reconstruction came from. A lot of it came from federal planning and research money that's available for this type of research. But an awful lot came from other states. Minnesota Local Road Research Board is a big supporter of this, since we've learned a lot about local roads with the research we do there, and industry. So out of that total amount, MnDOT really only funded about 15% of that reconstruction in 2008. So that was quite an accomplishment for us to change that business model to be more national in nature. This is just another chart that shows one of the ways that we get the collaboration is through pooled fund projects. And basically, different states or entities can pool their money into one pool for us to do the reconstruction and the research of these cells up there. So this just kind of demonstrates we had 17 states that participated in those seven pooled funds that were part of that construction, along with the Federal Highway Administration and the Local Road Research Board and industry. So $3.8 million of that approximately $10 million project was accomplished through these pooled fund type projects. So it's another model for us to make sure that everyone is involved and we all get the benefits from it. So it has been quite a change in kind of our business model for Min Road.
How many projects do you have going on at any one time?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm guessing about 50 different cells, but I don't know if Kurt knows better or not.
It's really hard to say because a lot of the cells overlap. You know, different research projects might use the same five cells. So I would guess at least 50 different things. And it's collecting data on all these cells, so if someone were to come back later and say, I'm curious about how this cell performed, they might have a study on something that we have the data for. That's one of the main things. We have this massive database, how all the cells are performing at any given time. So you could go back and create any kind of a project you wanted to.
I think we'll move to kind of some of our strategies for better pavement performance, and I'm going to let Kurt take over this part of the presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Kurt Turgeon, the pavement engineer from MnDOT, and I just want to start out with a slide that lists some of the commonplace approaches, things that we're doing as a regular basis at MnDOT for sustaining our pavements. Under the asphalt area, recycling asphalt pavement through the plant. In fact, that's something that was originally initiated here in Minnesota back in the 80s. Some people had a crazy idea and cut a hole in a plant and built some of the streets around the 3M complex, and that approach actually became what's commonly called the heat transfer method, is how all asphalt plants now recycle pavement. So as with many things, if you are the state that initiated it, you've been pretty liberal in or progressive in doing that. Right now we have one of the most progressive specifications for use of recycled asphalt pavement back to a hot mix plant. We, for the most part, allow 30% in all layers and all lifts. I see by the agenda you're going to have a lot of information about in-place recycling. I do have another slide discussing in-place recycling and what MnDOT's been doing. Polymer modification of asphalt cement. When we are doing a project, whether it's a brand new asphalt pavement or any other job, we're erasing that in-place crack structure, crack setup. We found that when we use a polymer modified asphalt, we can actually build asphalt pavements now that don't crack, or at least we've been building them using polymer modified asphalts for about 10 years, and just a drastic decrease in the amount of cracking when we use a polymer modified asphalt. War mix is a topic that's just coming kind of online in the last few years. Excuse me. It's essentially either a chemical or mechanical means to decrease the amount of fuel we need to burn at the plant, so we don't have to heat up the aggregates and the asphalt as much at the plant. So it's not hot mix anymore, it's warm mix. By decreasing that fuel consumption, there's some savings, there's some environmental value to not having the emissions from burning the fuel. And there's some, you know, just ease of handling in the field. Under concrete pavement, one of the things we're very interested in doing is replacing cement. Cement's one of the more expensive parts of the of a batch of concrete. We use fly ash and granulated slag to decrease our amount of cement in mixes. One of the things with concrete that's become very prevalent in the last few years is the use of additives that enhance a number of different factors. We think of concrete in terms of strength usually, but things like durability, permeability, we have additives that can make the concrete set up in a matter of minutes, or you can have additives that keep it from setting up for a matter of hours if you're going to transport it long distances, say up in northern Minnesota. We have permeability requirements and dense graded mixes, things that we're trying to do to decrease the amount of glue, the amount of space in between the rocks. So we're trying to minimize the amount of glue, minimize the amount of cement, make a higher quality concrete. With base construction, it's very common that we use recycled asphalt pavement in the base, recycled concrete. So if we have an old concrete pavement, it quite often gets crushed up and uses gravel base under the next pavement we place. We allow glass in our specification. When it comes to gravel bases, we get approached by just about everybody who has something they need to get rid of. Since we deal in tens of thousands of tons, people tend to think, well, we can sprinkle some of our product into your base and it'll go away. So we get approached by a lot of people to recycle products. And one of the things we're kind of a national leader on is pavement smoothness specifications. We have the van that Keith showed you that we use to document our existing condition. We now require the contractors to have that same technology so that when they pave a road, it's being measured and documented their ability to pave a smooth road, and we pay incentives to those contractors who do better than average. So that's really ratcheted up the quality of the product that we're putting out in terms of paving. With that, I'll just hit a few topics, things that kind of happening at Min Road and happening in research and pavements. One of them is this implements of husbandry study, essentially farm equipment. This study was initiated by the local road research board, primarily the counties, and they see these large pieces of equipment rolling up and down their roads. The roads aren't built to necessarily very high strength standards, and there are some concerns as to what kind of damage these types of vehicles are doing. So what has transpired is a cell, a relatively weak pavement was built at Min Road with sensors in it. There was a lot of people brought in to participate, including a group called the Professional Nutrient Applicators Association of Wisconsin. And I've never heard a farmer say they had nutrients stuck to their boot, but I guess that's the new term. But you see a long list of equipment and several DOTs. The study's been going on for a couple of years. As I said, they have these various equipments rolled across this pavement, and we're able to see what kind of damage relative to one to the other. One of the interesting things we just heard is a feedback from one of the people who are selling the equipment. You know, if you're hauling these large volumes of liquid, you have a choice between a massive trailer that moves very slow behind your tractor or a smaller truck that you can make many trips with. Before this study, it seemed like the farmers were leaning more towards the bigger trailers. But based on some of the preliminary results, this manufacturer said they're actually selling a lot more of the truck-sized, smaller, lighter vehicles, and the farmers aren't buying these big tankers. The anticipated result of this study is they'll go to the local road research board, and those people will look at the results, and they could potentially come to you folks and ask for some type of legislation on size or weights on some of this equipment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First blush, it appears that we're picking on vehicles of husbandry here. How does this compare with other surveys done, reference to semis, reference to garbage trucks? I mean, you talk about some of the cities, our roads were never built to handle a 10-ton garbage truck. So rather, you know, I'm really more interested in how it all compares together, because we shouldn't be just focusing on one enterprise here.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are 14 vehicles in the study, and one of them is an 80,000-pound five-axle semi. So everything's being compared back to the deflections that the standard truck would do versus, and some of these do less deflections, some do more, and it may not be a matter of eliminating some of these vehicles. For example, a grain cart, I believe there's already statements that they shouldn't be full. You shouldn't have a full grain cart going up and down the road. You should try and empty the grain cart before you take it across a paved road. This isn't a question of focusing on an industry as much as the county said, you know, what is that thing doing? That six-axle or three-axle, six-wheeled trailer that's hauling God only knows how many gallons, and they're bigger and bigger. The county engineer saw that and said, we need to get a handle on, we don't know what these things are. So this is a matter of, you know, which vehicle, how does it compare to a truck, and what can or should we do about it? So there isn't really a target on anyone's back here.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would just caution, if I took it first blush, I can imagine what some citizens might look at in their impression, first blush. And if you are, in fact, having all these vehicles, during presentation stage, this is just me, it would be nice if a snapshot of all, because in all reality, when you look at this, I'm going, my thought process was, it looks like we're focusing just on one industry when maybe just in the future, you know.
I understand. Mr. Chair, Senator, I understand. I had 25 slides and I'm down to six. trying to hit the highlights and field questions. And
thank you.
So,
thank you.
I also would add, Mr. Chair and Senator, that actually they approached us, the nutrient industry, because they wanted to know, you know, what impacts they were having, because they knew that was could be legislatively in other states they have passed legislation. So actually they initiated some of this also. So I think they also wanted to learn.
Sure.
From it, so.
Thank you.
Senator DeCray.
Thank you, Chairman. I work in the field of permitting superloads around the country. So I have an opportunity to speak to DOTs in a lot of different states. And sometimes this is county people, sometimes it's state people. But something, and I'd like you to comment on this, something that has that we've been told on several occasions, something that's harder on pavement is the speed. You know, the speed of vehicles going down the road as opposed to some of what we move, which is very, you know, extreme weights, but that they get a lot more damage from pavement based on speed of vehicles as opposed to, you know, being somewhat overweight. Would you comment on that and how you see that?
Mr. Church.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we could spend all day talking about pavement designs and how quickly a pavement of one type or another will rebound or whether or not it will rebound. You know, is for a superload, one of the things, if you spread it out, if you have enough close axles, it's actually, you're only bending the pavement once versus a bunch of axles that are a long ways apart and you bend and it relaxes and bend and relaxes. So it's a different animal. Yes, the quickness or the speed that you're bending something. I mean, if you just think of a paperclip and you're bending it in your hands, how far you bend it, how fast you bend it, those are all things that do impact how a road would fatigue. And so it's a very complicated thing to get into in a situation like this. But, yes, it can if you're dealing with a very thin pavement. If you're applying a relatively high load at a slow rate versus a fast rate, you can get different amounts of damage.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Turk.
Another topic that we've worked quite a bit on in Minnesota is something to dealing with tire pavement noise. We're one of four states that's really getting down to the well, I hate to use where the rubber meets the road, people love to say, but we actually have this equipment called onboard sound intensity, which is some high quality microphones that we put them right down next to the tire. We have a standard tire and we drive it over a variety of different surfaces. So we can compare and contrast which pavements are actually quieter. The thing we can control as pavement engineers is that pavement texture, both in terms of safety and in noise. So we have this equipment. We were approached by the diamond grinding industry. They have a variety of ways that they can grind and groove concrete pavements, and they said, I think we can optimize things both around safety and in noise. This picture in the middle, there's three or four different things. There's the original texture. There's three different grinds that they've tried. We measured the friction and the tire pavement noise on those. Through some iterations, we developed this pavement you see in the bottom right. That's kind of referred to as the next generation innovative grind. We did that on a couple small test projects, and that is actually the texture that was implemented this year on a project in Duluth. If you know, from Thompson Hill to downtown, there's a great deal of work going on. And ultimately, I believe most, if not all, of that surface will have this ground-in longitudinal texture that's very high quality in terms of friction and in decreasing tire pavement noise. And the International Grooving and Grinding Association gave us an award because we were willing to take the chance on this and move forward with implementing that. Recycling shingles into asphalt paving. We've actually been recycling manufacturer shingle scrap into pavement for quite a few years. Manufacturing facilities obviously have end runs and tabs and things, so we've been grinding those up and allowed those into our asphalt paving since 1995. Within the last couple of years, a number of different groups approached us about trying to work with tear-off shingles, tearing the shingles off your roof, grinding them up, putting them into asphalt pavement. Now, there's three differences primarily between a manufactured scrap and the stuff coming off your roof. Stuff coming off your roof has nails and boards and other junk in it. The stuff coming off the roof has been aged and sitting out there, and it's a different quality. In general, shingle asphalt is significantly different than the asphalt we put in roads to begin with. And there's a small, but anytime you're dealing with building demolition, the topic of asbestos is brought up. So with those three topics, we sat down with the PCA, the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board here in the metro area, some people who wanted to get into the business of grinding shingles, primarily people who were in the waste business, and some paving contractors, and we worked out ways that now that the shingles are being hand-sorted for the garbage, they're being tested to verify that there's no asbestos, they're grinding them to a quality product that we can incorporate into our paving. And as of 2010, they are allowed in our standard specification. Asphalt pavement reclamation, I see by the agenda we're going to have a number of different people talking about that topic. I just want to mention that we have been working with pavement reclamation for a number of years. Pavement reclamation project, in very simple terms, you have an asphalt pavement. Typically, we'll mill some of that off, take it back to the plant, run it through the plant to hot inf- so we have a product that we can hot recycle. You're left with a busted up asphalt there, kind of the bottom of your old pavement, sitting on a gravel base. You get a large rototiller type piece of equipment, you grind it up, now you erase that old crack pattern. And that's the thing that hurts overlays more than anything else, is that old crack pattern always comes back up. So we erase that crack pattern. As I mentioned, at that point, we'd probably put in a polymer-modified overlay. We get a long-term durable pavement out of it. Why aren't we doing more of that? Part of it is cost. It is an added cost to do this kind of work. We are working with a variety of products. So when you're rototilling that stuff up, you can actually add things like cement or asphalt or emulsified asphalt or combinations of those. Try and stabilize that, increase the strength of that rototilled layer so that you can decrease the thickness of your asphalt layer on top. We're still working out the dollars and cents of the cost of adding the additive to that base layer versus thinning up that asphalt overlay. We had three projects last year. I believe we're going to have nine projects in 2011, and as of now, there's about four projects scheduled for 2012, and by 2012, there may be more than that. There's a few more that are sort of on the bubble. Talking to districts, why don't they do more of this? A project of this type is in the neighborhood of $450,000 to $550,000 per mile. They look at their budgets, they look at their network, and they just say, you know, we don't have $500,000 a mile to fix this road as much as we'd like to. We got to do thinner fixes on more miles, as kind of referring back to Mr. Shannon's presentation is, you know, if you only got so many money, you got too many miles, you got to spread it thinner than we'd like to. We do have a cell at Min Road on the Interstate 94 that there's only 3 inches of hot mix on a stabilized base, but that's also sitting on a very strong sand subbase. Another area we're getting into is rehabilitation with thin concrete. Historically, we've looked at concrete pavements as sort of building a permanent road. If you look at the crosstown on Weed Louis, we go in there, we build something that's going to last a very, very long time. There are options if you have an existing pavement to put a relatively thin concrete pavement down. We did some of this on Min Road in 1997. As you see, we did some more in 2004, which tells you that we learned a lot from the ones in 1997. We learned a lot of things that we didn't want to do. We put some 3-inch thick concrete with some very small joint patterns and had some early problems with it. So from the 97 ones to the 2004 ones, we learned a lot. We've actually built now four projects, two north of Duluth. This photo is actually on Interstate 35 north of North Branch. We also have one on Highway 56 and south of West Concord. So we have this strategy that's also in that $400,000 to $500,000 a mile. Really looking at that bullet at the bottom, trying to get an alternate bid strategy going. And what do I mean by alternate bidding? Right now, as Keith mentioned, we have the STIP, so it's 4 years in advance. We're trying to figure out what projects we're going to build.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we move on, qualify that very, very long time for us. If you let's do it this way. If you take complete construction of a roadway with asphalt and with cement, what's the very long time projection? And then give us what's a long time when you're talking reclamation between asphalt and cement. Thank you.
We're doing a brand new pavement. Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm sorry. When you're doing a brand new pavement, we look at 50 years. We say, over a 50-year period, what are we going to have to do to maintain these two options? So we look at a concrete pavement. We ask, well, it gets a little messy because we look at the amount of traffic we're going to have in 35 years for concrete pavement. And we say, well, we need to build it so thick with the idea that we're not going to do a whole lot to that concrete pavement other than repair the joints, repair things that might deteriorate because it's going to, you know, weather and those kinds of things. So from a pavement design point of view, we say how much traffic is going to happen in 35 years. We actually think we're going to make the pavement last 50 years by doing some maintenance throughout that time. For an asphalt pavement, we know we're probably going to overlay it. So we say, well, we'll look at 20 years worth of traffic, and during a 50-year period of time, we're going to come back and we're going to overlay it. So we do more maintenance to an asphalt pavement than we do to a concrete pavement. So for a long time, for concrete, we'd be looking at 50 years. Or we'd be looking at 35 years worth of traffic, but 50 years worth of performance with all the maintenance. For a brand new asphalt pavement, we'd be looking at 20 years worth of traffic, but 50 years worth of performance with multiple overlays. So it's kind of a messy answer. So in general, we're trying to compare the two in a brand new reconstruct mode over a 50-year period with some different things happening to the different two pavements. Now, for these reclaimed thin concrete, we'd be looking more at a 35-year lifespan. We think that the asphalt will last, you know, 15, 18, 20 years maybe, depending upon how thick we make that top layer. The concrete might last that similar period of time. We'll do something at year 20 or so to make it last that last 35 years. So when we're picking these things, when we're comparing these things, it's not just how long will this one last, but it's also what are we going to have to do it to make it, to fix it? Because the cost of fixing it sometimes is the kicker in terms of which is the better option. So new pavements, 50 years, those kinds of pavements, 35 years, including some failure or some maintenance that has to happen during that time. Is that a convoluted enough answer? I'm sorry. I mean, it's a complicated thing that we do, and a lot of people like to, well, neither industry is happy with how we do it, but that's how we compare those.
Thank you.
What about the reclamation on just a grind and overlay? We know that the base is good. All we're going to do is get the improved drivability. We want to take off 4 inches and come right back with that again, not disturb the substructure of it. What is the expectation of the life of that type of approach?
Well, that would be very, Mr. Chair, that would be very similar to a reconstruct. A good example of that is Interstate 35 years south of downtown where there are no trucks. It's about 6 inches of asphalt. There was some cracking. It's got kind of an odd base that's doing some things to the asphalt. And we actually did mill the entire thing off and put an entire 6-inch layer back in there last year or year before. I guess it was the year before. So I would say that would be anticipated to perform similar to a brand new pavement then. When you're building a brand new road, you start with a blank sheet of paper and you can dig as deep as you want and haul in as much stuff as you want. But when you're dealing with a rehab, you kind of got to look at, well, okay, what do I have here? What's it going to cost me to do one thing or the other? You got to start with what you have. So an example like 35E, the thing that made the most sense was just to take off all of it, put it back down. What did they figure as their life was going to be? I'm not sure, but I would assume it's going to be similar to
the 35
brand
year
new road. Yep.
Thank you.
One more concept here, the alternate bidding. As I mentioned, we're programming jobs 3-4 years in advance. We try at this point try and pick a fix, an asphalt fix or a concrete fix or a reclaim fix. So we do a cost estimate to say an asphalt fix, a cost estimate for a concrete fix. We do some things in terms of what the maintenance is going to cost for each of those. We compare the two. We bring the maintenance back to today's dollars. Compare the two, and whichever one's cheaper, that's the one we build. That's sort of our standard operating procedure. The two problems with that is, one, we're doing it 3 to 4 years in advance of the project actually being built, and the other problem is we're doing an estimate, and an estimate is an estimate. So what we're trying to do with alternate bids is provide that typical section for an asphalt option, provide a typical section for a concrete section. We do some things with the maintenance costs to include those in the bid, but we ask the contractors, give us a price for the asphalt, give us a price for the concrete. We figure, well, which one's cheaper on the day of the letting, and then that's the one we're going to build. So we eliminate that time lag, and we eliminate the fact that we have to do the estimate. We're dealing with the real price. Those are the upsides of doing alternate bids. Some of the downsides is it does make for a very much more complicated plan. We have to provide all the information to do this letting. We have to provide all the information to build that product. There's some other complications with you know, what typical, what's fair in terms of the two typicals. My alternate is too thick. But ultimately, what other states have seen is they're getting more bidders. More bidders is going to equate to low prices. It's going to insulate us somewhat from commodity spikes. We've had issues with asphalt in 2008, went through the roof. Right now, cement as a commodity is very inexpensive. It's hard to project 3 to 4 years when those things might change. We had a few years ago where the polymers were very hard to get, so those were impacting our prices. So making the contractors bid it when they actually have to build it, it's going to insulate us from that. So far, we have let 4 projects using alternate bids. Those have been reconstruct kinds of projects, and now we're starting to look at expanding the program into doing these kind of reclaim versus thin concrete kind of bidding. And just a brief summary of both the presentations. The condition has been in decline since 2000, and 2009 was kind of our worst year for poor roads. 2010, we did see a slight uptick in the quality of our roads. I think we can track that to the Recovery Act, the additional money spent above and beyond our normal spending. In order to reverse this on a long-term basis, it's going to take a long-term financial dedication or putting more money into pavements, and we are trying to continue to implement as cost-effective strategies as possible.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's very, very good. Appreciate it. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Committee members.
Now we'll go into the presentation on pavement design and replacement. We have Daryl Pettis, David Meyer, starting. Mr. Pettis, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Senator. Daryl Pettis, I'm the Le County Administrator and the Le County Highway Engineer. I was asked today to come talk a little bit about bituminous reclamation that we have taken part in Le County, to give you a little bit of our experience, talking about full-depth reclamation and also a little bit about cold-in-place recycling. It's the first time I've ever been contacted by a Senate committee to come talk, so hopefully this works out okay.
Work out just fine, Mr. Pettis.
Map of Le County. We are a small southern county located just southwest of the metro area between here and Mankato. We have 14 townships and 10 cities within our county, a population of about 28,000 people as of the last census. A little bit about our highway system. We do have two systems that we are responsible for taking care of. We have 267 miles of county state aid highways. These are the roads that we do receive state gas tax and license tab fees for. In addition, we have 238 miles of county road. These roads are funded entirely by the local property tax. And of that, 300 miles are roughly paved and 205 miles are aggregate surfaced. Majority of our paved miles are on our state aid system, but we do have about 45 miles on our county road system. There's about 1,005 miles of total highways within the county, so we take care of just over 50% of all the road miles within the county, our county roads. This is a reclaimer. This is what we'll be talking about quite a bit. This is one of the models that was used by our contractor. This is Mid-States Reclamation's reclaimer. This is in 2008, our project I'll be talking about. We did a fairly large paving job that year. It was just over $9 million. We had about 11 projects in that 11 projects within that contract. Three of them did have reclamation. One was a cold-in-place recycling. I'd like to talk a little about those projects this time. As stated before, this is a giant rototiller. Think of a garden tiller, and this is just an upsized, beefed-up rototiller. It is computer-controlled. You can control depth. You can control grades. This thing will do a lot of different things. First project I'd like to talk about is County State Aid 24. This is located north of La Center, between La Center and La Sueur. The pavement is actually in pretty good shape. This pavement was only 14 years old. We had no intention in the spring of 2008 to work on this pavement, and we ground it up about 3 months later. Corn prices were up, road restrictions came off, and we had a lot of hauling on this road, and there were sections of this road that literally disappeared. It just crumbled. The grade went away, and we had some real problems. This picture doesn't really show that. It was determined that our issue there was we had a soft subgrade underneath the road surface that was causing deflection in the base and in the pavement. And for us to really fix it, we had to go down underneath and go after the problem. So here's the picture of a reclaimer basically taking the bituminous surface, which is about 4 to 4.5 inches deep, and grinding it down into the aggregate, which is underneath it, about 6 inches. You had about 10 to 11 inches of material that was ground up. Picture of it after it was ground up. You can see what was black is now brown. You can also see that the road is relatively new. It does have decent shoulders on it, decent inslopes. It was regraded or reconstructed about 1993 and then paved about 1994, 95 in that range. So it was relatively good grade or good grade lines. We had problems, issues with the grade underneath. We did come in with the help of a milling machine, and we actually loaded off the reclaimed material, took off about 9 or 10 inches of the reclaimed material, loaded on a truck, and moved it down the road to get it out of the way so we could work down on the subgrade underneath the base. Here's our reclaimer again. That white material that you see underneath the reclaimer is fly ash. We have incorporated about 6 to 7% fly ash. 14% fly ash into the subgrade at about a foot deep. This would take the moisture out of the clay subgrade, bind it up, and the fly ash becomes a semi-cementitious material, and then after compacting it, you get a very firm, dense grade to work off of. That's actually Tom Johnson there, the owner of the company, with the reclaimer, and then that's a water truck hooked to it, which you can't see. The hose leads into a water truck. You add water to the fly ash and the material, and it then stiffens the material up.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you talk a little bit about the fly ash? Is it my understanding that the state of Minnesota is somewhat sticky on the use of fly ash?
Mr. Pettis.
Senator Gimsey, members of the committee, yes, that is correct. There is a certificate or permitting process that we had to go through. This is an allowed use for fly ash as long as it is covered back up by an impervious surface such as pavement. There are some issues with fly ash. We are aware of that. But it is a very valuable and beneficial material for road construction. In addition, I believe that a lot of this material is actually being put into basically being put into landfills to be gotten rid of. We supply, the state provides more than is available or can be used up. We are aware of that, and we did follow the permit regulations that we had to follow.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry?
Are you aware of, are we one of a handful of states? My understanding is there's quite a few states that use fly ash in the building of their roads. Is that correct?
Senator Gimsey? Yes, that is correct. I know Kansas uses it, and Wisconsin uses it, but there are some issues with it.
Well, what type of issues are we talking about? Once it's ground up and put into that subbase along with the water, doesn't it become virtually concrete?
Yes, it does. That's correct, Senator.
Well, what would be the issues that we would have with that?
There are certain metals in it from the combustion of coal. That it is stabilized, put into the grade,
but they are in there. But we did follow the permit requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Pettis.
Just a picture incorporating the fly ash. Once again, it's going into the subgrade, incorporated in. And
excuse me, Senator Howell has a question.
Mr. Chair, can you tell me where is the fly ash coming from? Which facilities are they coming from?
This came out of Senator Gimsey, members of the committee. This came out of Black Dog.
All right.
Most of it came out of Black Dog. Some of it did come out of Winona also. I believe those are the only two permitted sources within the state.
Thank you.
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get a handle on this. Why do other states not have a problem with fly ash, and why do we have? I mean, is there something different with the way we get our fly ash here as compared to Kansas? I'm looking for that the main reason why we don't use it if it works so well.
Mr. Pettis.
Senator Gimsey, that's beyond my expertise. I can't answer that.
That'd be pretty great.
Okay. Incorporating the fly ash, we did grind this into the grade about a foot deep, a little over a foot deep at 14%. Just a picture of the reclaimer running through the grade. After the fly ash was completed, we did put the reclaimed agar base back down, and then we placed a 6-inch pavement on top of the reclaimed agar base. 2008. Project costs, as stated by the Kurt from the DOT, $500,000 a mile for this project. You can see the breakouts, the tabs, $9,200 for the reclamation, $26,000 to move it and put it back down the reclaimed aggregate, $24,000 for the soil stabilization, and then roughly just about $300,000 a mile for the bituminous surfacing. So the bituminous surfacing was about three-fifths of the cost of the project. Next one, this is County State Aid 13 between Elysian and Beaver Dam. Different sets of circumstances, different requirements, different fix that we came up with to do this. This was a relatively thin aggregate base. It was about 2 to 3 inches of aggregate. Underneath the pavement was about a 4-inch deep pavement. There was not sufficient material there to do a standard or one of our more normal cold-in-place recycling projects, so we selected to go to an emulsion stabilized fly ash into the full depth reclamated material. It's a picture of the emulsion tanker. That's what's in the truck. Emulsion is merely a mixture of water, asphalt, cement, and a surfactant, which is generally like a detergent. That is added into the reclaimer. The reclaimer mixes the fly ash into the aggregate and the bituminous, and it's compacted with the sheep's foot or the vibratory pad foot roller that's sitting behind the reclaimer. This is just a picture of all the processes kind of going on with the compaction equipment. That is the reclaimer to the left. In front of that is the pad foot roller, the sheep's foot, and then a rubber tired roller right behind that compacting the material. This project, total cost of about $472,000 per mile. And you can see the numbers for the emulsion, the reclamation costs, and then the price of the bituminous surface, about $300,000. A little bit cheaper, about 25,000 miles per mile cheaper. Last job we had was County State Aid 2. This is a different type of project. This is a full-depth pavement, deep strength. There is no aggregate underneath that pavement. It was merely the hot mixed asphalt was put right on the grade. We have a very tight yellow clay soil within our county. These roads are issues. We have trouble with these. We have some punching failures, and we've not had real good life out of them. The problem is the best pavement you have out there is what you see on the top. Generally, as you go down into the pavement farther, it gets worse and worse. You get some cracking that causes issues. You do have about 9 inches of bituminous sitting there, and you need to deal with that surface. Generally, what we used to do is just pull that all off and haul it away, recompact the subgrade, and then start over. But with diesel and fuel being up, we decided to go the direction of trying to deal with the material in place. This is a picture of the ground-up 100% wrap material that came out of the reclaimer. That It's a very difficult material to deal with because the fines like to fall to the bottom. It likes to segregate. So we added aggregate, a natural aggregate, into the material to give us a little bit more body to fill in the gradation. We can just have a bring your trucks in and haul in your natural gravel. It's a class 5 regular base material. And then incorporate, once again, we use 6% fly ash with the aggregate material and the wrap through the reclaimer. Incorporated that together, added water to it, compacted and rolled it, and then we use that as our paving surface. Prices for that was about $443,000 per mile based on 2008 prices. You can see the splits for the fly ash, the reclamation, and also the bituminous paving. Full depth reclamation, positives. It's very forgiving. Bad things can happen. It can rain. You can get soft spots. There's lots of things you can do with a reclaimer. It can help buy your way out of some of those problems. There's multiple processes that can be done. I went through the three that Le Sueur County used. There's also unstabilized full depth. You can also stabilize it using cement, fly ash, emulsion. Foamed asphalt is coming more prevalent. That's merely adding water to boiling hot asphalt, getting it to foam, and then recompacting that as a stabilized material. You can add material to correct issues, such as the wrap. We added the aggregate to it. And basically, the final product is a new pavement and should have the characteristics of a new pavement. Should have a long pavement life out of it. There are some downsides, though. We have closed our routes when we're doing this to traffic. It's very difficult. The material becomes very fluffy. People get stuck in it, so we generally have to detour traffic around. It is more expensive than just regular overlays or cold-in-place recycling. We had some get rained on. The pavement is open. The water will go right through your ground-up pavement, and you can get mud or soft spots in your grades when you're dealing with it. Material not be uniform. All you have to deal with on your reclaimer is the speed the reclaimer goes down the road. If that speed is speeded up greatly, you can get up with a lot of chunks underneath it, so you can get a very non-uniform grinding. Or if the reclaimer moves extremely slow, you can get a very you can grind your pavement into just dust. So you really have to watch your pavement speed, and sometimes those problems you don't find out about until after they're gone. You get chunks and things underneath. And also grade control. You can get, when you stabilize it, these things set up, and you can get ride problems. You can get waves and dips in your pavements. Cold-in-place recycling. This is the process we've done a lot more of. We started doing this in 2002. We've done these every year except for 2009. We did not do a cold-in-place job. This is a picture from 2002. This is Tom Johnson, Mid-States Reclamations paving train. What you see in front there is a milling machine, a screen, a pug mill, a crusher, and then the nurse tank, and the piece behind it is a pickup machine with a bituminous paver. This piece of equipment walks down the road of about 4,000 to 5,000 feet per day, picking up your material at a preset depth, adding oil to it, dropping it back on the road, and then laying it back through the paver, through a ski, to get a decent ride out of it. This process helps remove cracking and can help maintain or help keep your pavements in much better condition. Just a little close-up of it. A piece of equipment is about 150 feet long and weighs hundreds of thousands of pounds. If you have any soft spots in your road, that piece of equipment will find them. Trust me.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment on that. I was invited out this summer to Le Sueur County to watch that particular machine and that project do its work. And it is truly amazing how you can go through that reclamation process, windrow it, mix it, and then lay it out and have traffic on it within 2-3 hours. I mean, it's an interesting project. I'm sure if there's any more coming up, if anybody's interested, they would more than welcome any of us to just take a look at the process.
If I may, Senator, the project that you saw was actually the south end of the picture that was taken in 2002. Mm-hmm. So we have just about 9 years on that pavement right now. So. Right.
And how well is it holding up? Is it,
Senator, the pavement we did in 2002 was paved in the late 50s. It was an old road to begin with. It had multiple cracks in it. It's actually performing very well considering what we started with. It's 9 years old now, and we've got a crack probably every 150 to 200 feet on it. It's done very well. Before we did the project, we had a crack about every 2 feet. So these are, I know you can't read them in your handout, but this is our culled in place recycling job starting in 2002. This is through 2007. I did not add the 08 or the 10 projects. This slide shows 57 miles. We've got about 65 miles right now of cold in place. They're running around 250 to 280,000 a mile. A lot of that depends on the width of the pavement and the depth of the overlay. Positives for cold in place recycling. Yes, it can be constructed under traffic. We did do a job this summer south of Kasota between Kasota and Mankato, which has a high number of mines on it, aggregate suppliers. We were hauling on it after 2 hours with a load of gravel trucks. It did not damage the pavement. It does cut down your material hauling. You do not have to take material off or bring material onto the site. We have successfully used it to widen pavement from 12 or 11 or 12 feet to 14 feet. It has definitely cut down on reflective cracking. We do get a better pavement structure. Our ride has improved. And the reason we do it is it extends pavement life. An overlay goes about 10 to 14 years. We should get between 20 to 22 years out of most of these pavements. But there is a cost to that. Negatives. If you do not have an aggregate base, don't even play, because you will have problems with cold-in-place recycling. You will break through, and you will have a mess. It's more expensive, mill and overlay or basic overlay. Crowns, if you have a road that's out of shape, as far as crown and super elevation, this process cannot correct it because you're not bringing materials in. You're pretty much set with where you're at. Crack sealant, some of the old crumb rubber crack sealants, the crack sealants that came out in the 70s or 80s were made out of melted tires. We'll plug up this process. You get snakes that come off the top. It's a real mess. Your contractor just loves it. You do have to deal with it, though. You have to clean them up. But crack sealant can be a real problem, and it does not work on all pavements. This is actually a picture of a job that we did do in 2003. This is my county State Aid 13 south of Cleveland. That was what the pavement looked like before we did it. Right now, I don't have a new picture of it, but it is in good shape. It's got a crack about every 150 to 200 feet in it. We have extended its pavement life. That pavement was put down about 1960, so we've gotten 50 years out of original pavement. Engineers are asked to do many things regarding pavements. There is no smoking gun or perfect solution. We do try to employ crack sealant. We try to employ seal coating, overlays, cold-in-place recycling, full-depth reclamation, and even reconstruction. Each road has a different set of circumstances to it. Trying to blanketly apply all these technologies does not work. A lot of it is trial and error. Some of it is seat-of-the-pants engineering. This is kind of what we are up against. And there's my information.
Hey. Thank you, Mr. Pettis. Appreciate your presentation. And we have 20 minutes left, roughly, for three additional testifiers on different processes of reclamation. We appreciate Mr. Mayor. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is David Meyer. Thank you, Patrick. I am the major market manager for Lafarge North America. We sell cement and fly ash to the construction industry. Again, this is also my first time. I have been asked to present on behalf of Tom Johnson with Mid-State Reclamation to talk about some of the opportunities and frustrations of pavement recycling. So I apologize if I get a little candid at some points here, but these are what we're seeing in the field. So a lot of what I was going to talk about has been covered very well by Mr. Pettis, so we can move through some of this pretty quickly. In fact, I see we've jumped right to my second part here, the project highlights. But We've already talked about sort of what fly ash is. It is a type of cement, or it acts much like a cement. And in talking about full depth reclamation with cementitious materials, both fly ash or cement can be used almost interchangeably. I'm going to talk about two project highlights, and then some of the other opportunities we've had in neighboring states, and some of the roadblocks we've seen with adoption here in our state as well. So we've already heard about Le Sueur County. Another one of our early adopters is Chisago County. Very similar story. They had 12 miles of filled county roads that back in 2007, near North Branch off of I-35, we looked at recycling with this process. So the other options that were available were removal and replacement of the road. That is taking out the existing road structure, taking out the materials that have already been paid for by the taxpayers, mining new materials and bringing that back in and putting it in place. And that is simply cost prohibitive. It's not a wise use of taxpayer dollars, and it's not very sustainable. Structural overlays were another option. They need to be, when you have a situation where the base is in failure mode, your overlay needs to be structural, which means you cannot get by with simply a thin overlay, which will enhance the ride, but in a few years later, you're right back where you were. So there are options of both concrete and thick asphalt overlays that could be used. But in the end, Chisago County chose to do in-place recycling with fly ash. You're familiar with the process already. Fly ash is ground in with the big rototiller machine, the reclaimer. It's compacted, water's added. It essentially cements and glues the road base together, which more than doubles its load carrying capacity. Fixes all the problems in the base, and then you can come back with an asphalt or a concrete wearing surface. In the case of Chisago County, the engineer reported to me that it was 30 to 40% the cost of his next best option, which was removal and replace. So here's a couple pictures from that job. This is the fly ash that's been placed on the grade. It is placed with a dustless spreader, so there's no dust blowing around. As you see, it stays where you put it. I like this shot because it shows an area going over a culvert, and you see none of the material is running away, none of it's washing into the culvert. This is a valuable construction material that's being used responsibly and precisely. So we've seen the reclaiming machine. Again, it pulverizes the material, mixes your fly ash or cementitious cement material uniformly. It is computerized, very tight tolerances. Water is added right in the mixing drum. So this is really truly an in-place process. You bring in very little new material to a site. All you would need to bring in is your binder, whether it's fly ash or cement. So if you think about the amount of material that it has to be brought in terms of aggregate, you have to mine that material, you have a lot of trucks, you have a lot of emissions. When you're looking at pavement recycling in place, you're bringing in a small amount of binder and you're using the material that's already been paid for by the taxpayers. It really, truly is a good, sustainable option. So here's the mixing and compaction stage. You've got the reclaimer that's going on down the roadway, followed by the sheep's foot roller. That would be followed again by a smooth tired roller or a steel drum roller that compacts it. Once it's in place, just like you saw from Mr. Pettis' presentation, it looks just like a compacted road. You can trim it. You can finish grade it. It does seal up with water, so if it rains while you're in this process, it will shed the water and will not disturb the surface. And then within several days, you can come back and put your final paving surface on top. This project, and I appreciate Senator Perry talking about how interesting it is to see these processes, we actually documented this with a professional film crew. And if you have my folder, there is a DVD in that folder. It's an 8-minute video that, for sake of time, I did not show here. But I'm very proud of it. It shows the process from start to finish. It also has some recommendations from Lisa Gravner from the US EPA that supports the use of fly ash and has actively promoted the use of fly ash. And again, the process you see in the video, although it's focused on fly ash, it can be just as easily done with cement. It's simply a different percentage of application rate. So you'll see testimony in that video from the county engineer at the time and the assistant county engineer, who is now the county engineer, Joe Triplett of Chisago County. Plus, there's testimony from a local geotechnical engineer and an official at Xcel Energy that supplied the fly ash. So I please encourage you, if you're interested in the process, please watch the video. So those 12 miles we did were in 2008. We had done a test section earlier in 2007. This is a picture of that. As you can see, it's holding up very well. So you fix the base. That's the root of a lot of your problems. If you fix the base properly, you've solved a lot of those problems. So we've already had a nice presentation on MinRoad. We did participate in a MinRoad section. There was a grant from the U.S. EPA, MnDOT, University of Wisconsin, Madison, and University of Minnesota was involved. Lafarge was a substantial contributor as well. Those test sessions are in place. That person you see with the ball of material in his hand, he was the regional representative from the U.S. EPA. So it is a process that they have been promoting for decades, including the use of fly ash, which as lately there have been some concerns over the environmental status of fly ash, but it is and remains a product and a process that is supported by the EPA and it does not pose a threat to health or other environmental issues. So out of that, the Transportation Engineering and Road Research Alliance published this document, and I believe you have copies of this as well. It covers the test cells. It talks about the section with the fly ash in it, as well as a section that used asphalt emulsion, and a section that I believe was just ground-up aggregate. On the last page, made the statement in 2007 that several FDR projects have been planned for the 2008 season by MnDOT and local agencies. And this is a part where I apologize for being a little candid, but as a supplier of material and representing a contractor, 2008's come and gone, 2009's come and gone, 2010's come and gone, and we're still talking about trial projects and research projects, and the rate of adoption of this process has not been really as fast as any of us would have hoped. So if you look at other projects that we've done for a list of counties, and this is by no way comprehensive, these are the ones that I personally have been involved in. There are other suppliers of these materials in the state. So this is what Lafarge has been involved in, a project in Anoka County, several in Chisago County, several in Le Sueur County, Washington County, Wright County. Several of the cities as well have done sections, Waseca, Lakeville. We already talked about the MinRoad section, a couple of townships near New Prague. We look a little wider to commercial work, literally dozens and dozens of commercial projects, Costco buildings, parking areas at the B&W site out in Minnetonka. There's been Target developments. There's been a lot of commercial work where there's been a site that instead of bringing in a lot of dry virgin material to improve the site to give a to provide a roadway, they can take the existing native soils, bring in a small amount of a binder, grind it up, and it is the most cost-effective option, which gives them very good strength and durability. Runway extensions. This is a process that the FAA endorses for runways. We've done a lot of them in Wisconsin. We've done several of them in Minnesota as well. Wind farms are the biggest up-and-coming application. There's 21 miles of wind farms happening, roads going into wind farms down in Lakefield. It's very cost-effective. It supports the massive amount of weight that's coming in from those wind farm towers and those cranes. And at the end of the day, the material is covered with a little bit of gravel and turned back over to the county. So these are going to be excellent roadways that the county gets to use after this wind farm is done. So when we look briefly, I generalized this data. The question was asked earlier of how do we compare to other states. I could not show specific sales by Lafarge, but what I did instead was I took sales of Lafarge over a four-year period. The blue section at the top is the Minnesota sales. I've set that at 100%, and I've compared the other sales to those. So if you go clockwise around there, Wisconsin would do 4.78 times the amount of volume that Minnesota has done over the last 4 years. Illinois, 12 times the amount. Michigan has done 6.5 times the amount that has been done in Minnesota. Missouri, 5 times the amount. Kansas, almost 10 times the amount. So this includes cities, counties, MnDOTs, and commercial work that Lafarge has sold product. We have competitors in these markets, so these numbers are skewed. They're much higher when you get to Kansas, Missouri, and those states, Illinois, where this is really an accepted practice and very widely done. I tried to show states that were in our general region where we had the same freeze-thaw concerns and some of the same environmental issues, but this is not new technology. So, you know, I usually call these opportunities, but because we're dealing with roadways, I kind of went with the roadblock deals. You know, whether you're talking to private companies, cities, townships, counties, or the DOT, there's just a lot of inertia. As we've heard before, these are complicated decisions, and I respect that. It's not easy to come in and say, you know, this is what should be done everywhere. Each site is different. However, it's taken a long time to build a critical mass with the cities, the counties, and MnDOT here in the state, and that's been one of the challenges. The question
excuse
was
me.
Brought up.
Senator Hall has a question. If that's
sorry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, in the interest of time, I've got a couple of questions that maybe you can just get back to the committee at a later time. I don't want you to answer them
sure.
now, but just how much fly ash is created in Minnesota? How much could we use if this process was adopted? And then what are the, what are the permitting or getting licensed to be able to use that fly ash from various deals? What is the process of which a creator of fly ash would have to go through? But I know we have some other people to testify, so if you could just provide that to the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Senator Howell, this is my last slide, so I could handle it very briefly,
okay.
if that's okay. But there are several hundred thousand tons of fly ash generated in this state. Of that, a very small amount is permitted by the MPCA, which is the fly ash that I sell. Farther down on my list, there is redundancy of environmental agencies. We've done our due diligence with the MPCA. The US EPA supports the use, but we also have the MnDOT Environmental Office, which creates another layer. Those three layers, those redundant specs, have really held back the use of this product.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert, and then Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you move any of your product through the port terminal in Duluth?
Senator, we move quite a bit of cement through Duluth,
mm-hmm.
No fly ash.
Okay.
Again, cement can be used in this process as well.
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chairman, just a note on the Waseca project. I believe that was Engineer Fred Salisbury from the city.
Yes, sir.
Matter of fact, part of that project is just down the street from where I live. And it was amazing how this garnered national attention. Matter of fact, Senator Coleman, it was taken all the way up to Washington, and they were amazed at the strength and the reliability. And still, as I look at that part of the street that we have, it is the strongest part, even though it's a city street. But it seems that after it received some glowing reports here in the state, it just seemed to disappear. And that's what my big concern is if in fact this is really something that is very beneficial or could be beneficial to the long-run cost of reclamation, and that it should be looked at.
Well, Senator Perry, we are looking and searching for the best, most efficient ways to improve our highways and to move forward with the limited budgets that we certainly have now and will have in the future. And you know, one of the reasons why we're having this presentation today is to invite you to talk about this and to open the door to the possibility that we may be able to move forward like so many of the other states have with this type of a reclamation process. So there will be future discussions about it as we get going. So. Right. Well, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Meyer. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Senators.
Mr. Hall. And why don't we have Mr. Hall and Mr. Gerster, come up, both come up, and we'll spend 10 minutes here. Go over a little bit and have you testify since you can.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to sit before you today. I must admit, this is only the second time.
State your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Don Hall. And I have to say, this is only my second time here, except for, I think, in seventh grade, I was through this building once. So please forgive me. As I said, for the record, my name is Don Hall. I currently hold the position as Vice President of Hard Drives Incorporated, Rogers, Minnesota. And I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association, and I hold the co-chair position on a joint AGC-MnDOT-Bituminous Committee. We have been a family-owned highway heavy paving contractor in Minnesota and North Dakota since 1963. Our major business focus is bituminous paving. We produce and place annually 1.3 million tons per year, with at the peak of the construction season 300 employees. I'm here before you today to speak on recycling and green initiatives in construction. As Mr. Turgeon graciously pointed out already today, that Minnesota asphalt contractors have been recycling asphalt for over 35 years already. According to the FHWA study, the asphalt industry recycles more than 100 million tons per year, making it America's number one recycler, saving American taxpayers an estimated $1.8 billion per year. As a matter of fact, more tons of reclaimed asphalt pavement are recycled than newspaper, steel, and aluminum combined. In Minnesota, an annual average nowadays of 12 million tons of asphalt is placed per year. If every ton was recycled to its maximum, Minnesota could save an estimated $120 million per year. Asphalt pavements are perpetual. Perpetual pavements constructed from asphalt are the ultimate in sustainability. When appropriately designed and constructed, the road itself does not wear out. The roadway can be milled, recycled, and overlaid quickly with the least amount of congestion. I gave everybody, I think you have packets in front of you, which show asphalt recycling off the road. There's some pictures specifically of the roadway out front here on 94 where we milled off the surface, recycled it, and brought it back. So those specific pictures are from Highway 94 here. And the pamphlet there, you can read at your leisure, but it goes into asphalt and the sustainability of it. There's some issues and concerns in the marketplace that we see. Fuel and oil prices are a large input cost for construction. Unstable and unpredictable markets will continue. With the increases of trucking costs, production costs, and scarce aggregates, recycling can lessen our dependence on foreign oil and inventory fluctuations. Incorporation of scrap and tear-off shingles provides beneficial reuse of resources and ultimately reduces the costs further in the end product. As Mr. Turgeon pointed out, we are a leader in the asphalt shingles environment. We need to continue to monitor and for increased usage. Observations and obstacles that we foresee and have been experiencing. Public owners have been slow to embrace aggressive use of recycled products. Narrowly worded specifications inhibit growth of recycling, and lack of specification uniformity between MnDOT and local specifiers. Specifically, some write out recycling in its entirety. Our recommendations that we can offer: contractors are increasingly interested in using higher percentage of reclaimed aggregate and asphalt pavement materials to take advantage of economic and environmental benefits while still producing a quality end product for the buyer. FHWA considers recycling a standard in the design of asphalt pavements. FHWA writes, "Restrictions that prohibit the use of recycled material without technical basis should be removed from the specifications." The engineering and feasibility of using recycled materials has been demonstrated in research, field studies, experimental projects, and long-term performance testing and analysis for over 35 years here in Minnesota. Recycled asphalt pavements is a great long-term investment. It can be incorporated into existing standards for pavement design, construction, maintenance projects, and safety assurances for the public. Recycled materials should be the standard, and virgin products should be the permissive option. We need to maximize the benefits and savings for reuse. We all benefit from recycling, but most of all, we can achieve increased quality at a reduced cost. I thank you for this time today, and I would entertain any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Appreciate your testimony on this, and see any questions from the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Gerster.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members. My name is Steve Gerster. I'm with PCI Roads. We're a concrete paver here in Minnesota, do bridge repair as well. We employ, at peak of our season, about 450 employees here in Minnesota. So we're a rather large highway contractor here. And I guess the reason I'm here, I was asked on quite short notice. I don't have a presentation. I'll make this quick because I know you guys are all pinched for time. But we didn't want this to be a wholly an asphalt sales meeting. So I represent the concrete. As a concrete contractor, I'm here representing the concrete industry. So certainly we do a lot of work with good companies like Donnie's, and they're wonderful companies, so there's nothing here to say negative about them by any means. But concrete is also 100% recyclable. Nothing goes to the landfill, hasn't for many, many years. There's been a lot of talk here today about reclaiming, and of course the majority of the reclaiming process is all about the base, and I think we all know that you got to have a good base to put anything on, and all these reclaiming options are wonderful for concrete too. You just put concrete over the top instead of asphalt, so the same thing applies. It just works perfectly for that, and I think one of the reasons we haven't seen a lot more of it here in Minnesota, and I don't want to speak for the DOT, but it is a very expensive fix, and unfortunately their funds are limited, and that's all we ever hear in the concrete industry, because we're always going, how come we can't get a bigger share of the pot? And it's all about, well, we only have so much money and we can only afford paint, and you know, we need new siding, but all we can afford is paint. That's what we hear all the time. So I think that's one of the reasons you don't see a lot of the reclaiming. But there actually is a fix with concrete for every one of these issues. There's thin overlays. They mentioned earlier the Chisago County job up on 35. Probably many of you have driven over that road. Nothing but 3 inches of mill out the asphalt that had deteriorated from, as it does in full-depth asphalt, from the bottom up. Mill off the top and put a new wear course over it, really, is what that amounts to. And I think anybody who's driven over that road would say that's a beautiful fix for that road and expected to last a long time. And Mid-Road has many examples of 3- and 4- and 5-inch concrete that have seen a lot of easels. They don't last a lot of years out there, as Kurt mentioned, because there's the traffic there is unbelievable. But the reclamation process itself, what I want to mention, too, is you look at Keith Shannon mentioned the chart about the ride quality and the poor condition of the pavements. And, of course, that's increasing every year. And our stance in the concrete paving industry would be that we continue to spend money on short-term fixes. And that's a lot of these magic bullet thin kind of pavements that just aren't getting us any place in terms of our system. And I think his graph showed that. And I think we all need to look at a little bit longer-term fixes. And that's where concrete is at its best. And I think that's how people think of concrete as a long-term fix. But we certainly have all the short-term fixes today, too. Freeborn County, we've done a reclaim project there, very similar to what they're talking about here, except you don't need to inject any oil in with the concrete. You just do your reclamation, a little gravel over the bituminous, reclaim that product as a base, and put your concrete over the top, and you have your 35, 40-year design, whatever they're using. So anyhow, I guess as far as fly ash goes, too, that was a big deal here, and everybody wants to know why we aren't using all the fly ash. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but concrete's been utilizing fly ash as a cement replacement for, I suppose, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 years. And I gotta believe, I think Dave Meyer mentioned 200,000 tons or so of fly ash that's available for use. I got to believe the concrete industry already is using probably 60 or 70% of that material already going into concrete. So we use 30% replacement mix in concrete pavement is fly ash. So as far as green and sustainability, we've been doing those things for a long time. Anyhow, I guess the bottom line for us, and I know everybody's short of time here, but we wanted to make sure we got up in front of you. And it's not just about asphalt. It's about the condition of our roads. It's about how long they're lasting. It's about how much money we're spending on them. And there's numerous fixes for both of those. The DOT certainly is looking at those all the time and working with both industries to try to make things better. We have all the same fixes that the other side has. So I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware of that. Thank you.
Certainly. Well, thank you for your testimony, and we appreciate it. With that, we have a question, Senator Perry.
Well, just a comment. And we don't need to discuss it here. But one thing that I would like to have an answer for is if, in fact, we're using so much fly ash in the cement for the roads, why is it that the asphalt side feels that this is? They're being hampered by it. Why can't both sides use the same? I guess that would be the question. Because I was led to believe when the asphalt folks were here is that they're having issues with the EPA or the PCA about using fly ash, and now we just hear that it's being used regularly with cement. So that, Mr. Chairman, if we could some way get an answer on that down the road. I don't think we need to take time now, but
certainly. Well, why don't we plan on charging MnDOT to answer that for us?
That'd be great.
I think it's a very good question. If we're using it in asphalt already and we mix it up into the subbase and it becomes like asphalt and firms up and allows us to move forward with projects on a better structural base, why aren't we doing that? And